Bubbles are fun. But sometimes I like to retreat into a little bubble and live in it. Sometimes I like to just dwell in a little bubble of happiness and pretend that everything's right with the world. In my bubble, there's lots of happiness and lots of joy, and everyone agrees with reconciliation. Everyone agrees with loving your neighbour. Everyone agrees with showing charity and compassion and kindness. It's a caring bubble. It's a nice place to be. But I get dragged out of my bubble repeatedly, because not everybody does agree with these things. At least they might in theory, but we don't have to look too far to see that actually the world isn't about kindness and love and compassion and reconciliation. We probably don't have to venture too far beyond our front doors. Some of us might not even need to venture beyond our front doors to realise that the world isn't such a happy, lovely, kind place. Some people think that there is an Aboriginal problem. Others think that Indigenous people are in the situation that they're in now because of something that they've done or something that they haven't done. Others argue that we've done loads for them already. It's time they helped themselves. I've had hate mail because of this role, which is astounding. I've had hate mail for trying to push on the agenda of reconciliation, and I've been told that I have no right to do that. I've been told I'm not really Aboriginal, and I get left kind of defending my heritage, and sometimes I feel like I just even have to defend my existence. Other people, of course, are more generous and think that the situation that we find ourselves in as a nation isn't an Aboriginal problem, but is in fact a problem for all of Australia. And they think that reconciliation is a great idea, but don't know what to do about it. Some people think that reconciliation is a fine ideal, but not a realistic one. Perhaps you fit into one of those categories. Perhaps you think something completely different. Perhaps you don't actually really care. It doesn't affect you, and so you don't really think much about it at all. But reconciliation is a clear biblical message. We have been reconciled to God through Jesus, and we must be reconciled to one another. I've steered clear of preaching on our passage today since I've been in this role. I don't know that I've purposefully avoided it, but I did hesitate when choosing it, partly because it seems a bit obvious, and partly because the argument of 2 Corinthians is a hotly debated issue, mainly due to the questions about the unity of the letter. Our passage today has been described as one of the most memorable sections of the New Testament. Irish Bishop and Professor of Systematic Theology Richard Hanson refers to it as one of the charters of the Christian ministry in the New Testament. British biblical scholar C.K. Barrett calls it one of the most pregnant, difficult, and important in the whole of the Pauline literature. French theologian and reformer John Calvin's comment just on chapter 5, verse 18 is arresting. He says, "Here, if anywhere in Paul's writings, we have a quite remarkably important passage, and we must carefully examine the words one by one." So while I'm in sympathy with Kelvin's remarks about the necessity of carefully studying this remarkable passage, you'll be pleased to know that we're not going to examine the words one by one today. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul is in the middle of his appeal to the church in Corinth to recognise his personal integrity and apostolic authority. The section is intensely theological and strikingly personal, for Paul's theology and his manner of ministry will stand or fall together. His ministry is characterised not by living for himself, but by living for the one who died for him and rose again. And he presupposes that it is in fact impossible to separate the gospel message from the messenger of the gospel. I think we should consider it in the same way. We cannot preach a gospel of love, grace, mercy, and reconciliation without expressing those same things in our own lives, in our own actions, in our own words. The real proof of our understanding of this passage is in our competences as agents of reconciliation in this hostile world. Reconciliation with each other, with our First Nations peoples, with strangers, with friends, with enemies. Reconciliation with each other. But there is a sentence in today's passage that made me wonder more. It made me stop and think about the way Australian Christians might view or reorient our view of reconciliation with our First Peoples. The NIV translation of verse 16 says, "So from now on we regard no one from a worldly point of view. Though we once regarded Christ in this way, we do so no longer." And from the NRSV that we heard this morning, it says, "From now on, therefore, we regard no one from a human point of view. Even though we once knew Christ from a human point of view, we know him no longer that way." Worldly point of view or human point of view could also be translated as according to the flesh. Paul sees Jesus differently now. He once saw Christ as a criminal rather than the Messiah, but not so now. But Paul also makes a parallel between looking at Jesus in a different and complete way and looking at each other in a different and a complete way. Because he goes on to say in verse 17, "So if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away." See, everything has become new. Now, none of us are divine. So what is the parallel here? Well, the parallel, according to Paul, is that because we are all in Christ, we are more than just human. There is more to us than meets the eye. We have dwelling with us the Spirit of God. Christ's death means that from now on a radically different way of viewing reality is present for us. No one is to be viewed according to the old order with its fleshly priorities and values. Even if Paul has known Christ in this manner, those days are gone forever. Further, the former fleshly worldview has been replaced by a distinctively Christian one. I didn't know about my Aboriginal heritage until I was in my late 20s. I did have a parishioner at one parish say to me, fairly recently, "But you only look like you're in your 20s. I thought she was delightful. I somehow slipped into my mid-40s without even realising, and I woke up one day going, "How did that happen?" So here I am in my mid-40s, having had now quite a few years to reconcile in my own life what it means to be an Aboriginal Australian and what it means to have had that denied to me for so long. I remember all through my childhood and early adulthood asking my nana about it. There was something in her story that just didn't make sense. There was something in my heart that didn't make sense. I felt sure that she was hiding something. My Nana was a very proud and determined woman, and I thought there is more here than what she will let me see. She would explain away her features by telling me that we were Portuguese. Except every Aboriginal person that I had ever met, and I grew up near Mildura, so like Swan Hill, there are a lot of Aboriginal people. Every single one of them would just presume that I was. And they were astounded when I said, no, we're Portuguese. But there was one person who said almost prophetic words to me one day. Auntie Emrose was a local elder, and her family would work on our farm sometimes. I was naturally drawn to them, and I would sit with them at Smoko and listen to them. We'd have a yarn at Smoko. How's that for an Australian catch cry? When I was still just a young teenager, she said to me, Helen, maybe one day the truth will come out and you'll be able to be reconciled with your past. You'll learn that you are one with us and that you always were. She went on to tell me that sometimes things are hidden to protect us. You see, my Nana was born in 1914, just a few years after the implementation of the assimilation policy, which focused primarily on children who were considered more adaptable to white society than Indigenous adults. Consequently, one of the main features of the assimilation era was the forced removal of Indigenous children from their families, causing enormous stress in my Nana's family. Between 1910 and 1970, for six decades, which was essentially a lifetime at that time. That was about what a life expectancy was, about 60. So for a generation, an entire generation, for 60 years, generations of children were removed under these policies, and they've become known as the stolen generations. And that S on the end is really important, because it wasn't just one generation of children that were removed. For 60 years, 60 years, children were forcibly removed from their families. Children of mixed heritage, like my Nana, were particularly vulnerable to removal, as it was thought that they could be more easily assimilated into the white community because of their lighter skin. The policies of child removal left a legacy of trauma and loss that continues to affect Indigenous communities, families and individuals. But it also left a lasting legacy on those not stolen. It taught many of them, like my Nana, that it was a bad thing to be Aboriginal. We didn't have our heritage stolen because of forced removal. We had our heritage stolen because we were told that it was shameful to be who we were, that we were less human because of who we were. And so when my Nana's mother died, when Nana had a very young child of her own, my dad, who was just two, she took in her younger siblings to raise them. She was 22 years older than her youngest sister, who was just a year older than my dad. My Nana was suddenly motherless, a young mother, and now surrogate mother to her three youngest siblings. And so she reinvented herself. She reinvented her past, and she dictated what her future could now look like. She was no longer Aboriginal. I always suspected that the Portuguese story was just that, a good story to explain away some exotic-looking features. It turns out that it wasn't just a story, that we do have Portuguese ancestors. They were slave traders. It was better to be a descendant of a slave trader than it was to be Aboriginal. That doesn't make sense in a modern world. It doesn't make sense to me. And yet, for my Nana, she could be prouder of being a descendant of slave traders than she could be in her own skin. Assimilation, including child removal policies, failed in its aim of improving the life of Indigenous Australians, though, because of the contradictory logic behind assimilation. It expected Indigenous people to take responsibility for becoming the same as white people, but it never gave them the same rights or opportunities to do so. Regardless of their efforts, Indigenous people were not accepted as equals in a society that still considered them to be an inferior race. The essential belief in the inferiority of Indigenous people and their culture undermined the objectives of the assimilation policy and led to its failure. The devastating impact of assimilation policies on families and culture continues to affect Indigenous communities today. It wasn't until 1973 that policies for Aboriginal people stopped being made under the Flora and Fauna Act. The laws for plants and animals. 1973, and we were still considered subhuman, less than a white person. You might not have noticed, but there are still some subtle messages that we weren't considered human well beyond this point. Have you ever noticed what's on the tails side of our coins? I'm going to do a little quiz with you. Our 5-cent coin has on one side Queen Elizabeth, and on the tails side it has an echidna. And on the 10-cent coin? A lyrebird. And the 20-cent coin? A platypus. You're very knowledgeable on this side. This side likes money. Now, the 50-cent coin, of course, is a little bit of a trick because we have special editions of the 50, $1 and $2 coins. But our traditional 50-cent coin has the coat of arms, an emu and a kangaroo. And the dollar coin? 5 kangaroos. And the $2 coin? The head of an Aboriginal man. The $2 coin has the face of an Aboriginal man. It was introduced in 1988, the year of bicentenary. All of our coins up until that point had a native animal on it. Now, I don't know if it was intentional, if it was just overlooked, but the inferred meaning is that Aboriginal people are like our native animals. It's really a little bit offensive. It's the permissions that we kind of give each other that go, that's all right, and we neglect to see how it affects somebody else. My Nana wasn't stolen, but she grew used to the almost obsessive way her mother cleaned the house and clothed her children so as to prove to the authorities that would visit to make sure that she was a capable parent, that she could care for her children as well as any white person could. My Nana was lucky not to be removed from her family, but she learnt that it was unbearably shameful to be Aboriginal. She also learnt that as an Aboriginal person, you just can't win. We were too black to be considered human with the arrival of the First Fleet and colonisation. And now people question your heritage and your Aboriginality if you're not black enough. Too black to be human, not black enough to be Aboriginal. The policy of assimilation told us to conform to white people's ways. And when we have, we get told we're not really Aboriginal. So we did what we were told to do, and then told, oh, you're not really Aboriginal. The continued stereotype that Aboriginal people only live in the desert, in Central Australia, and look a certain way means that when you don't live or look like that, you're constantly questioned and defending your heritage. We need a new way of looking at our First Nations people, a new way of looking at reconciliation and the nature of Australia. Waleed Ali wrote earlier this year in response to the media outrage that the University of New South Wales has a years-old guide on Indigenous terminology, that the debate about Indigenous history in Australia always descends into hysteria because it bruises our misplaced national pride. He says that our Indigenous history, our founding tragedy, has been steadfastly denied ever since because once we admit it, we have nowhere to go with it. No way of rehabilitating our pride, no way of understanding ourselves. Because how do we understand ourselves in light of the terrifying and atrocious statistics that surround suicide in Indigenous communities? When 95% of Indigenous people are affected by suicide, when they are 6 times more likely to commit suicide, when 75%, 3/4 of children committing suicide are Indigenous, and when 80% of youth suicides are Indigenous young people. What does that say about us? What does that say about our failure to respond? There isn't a word for suicide in any of the Indigenous languages. There were around 700 dialects prior to colonisation, and not one of them had a word for suicide because the concept of suicide just didn't exist. Suicide was almost non-existent in Indigenous communities even up until the 1980s, and now it's reached staggering and horrific proportions to the point that our Indigenous children have the world's highest suicide rate. The thing that's missing in many of these communities are the pathways and access to opportunities and to the benefits of education and hard work which the rest of Australia does have access to. These communities continue to be neglected by state and federal government jurisdictions and their agencies. Services and layers of community infrastructure just haven't been grafted into these communities, and instead they're dilapidated third world environments. We need a new way of thinking about things and seeing these things. Because how do we understand ourselves in light of the alarming incarceration rates when an Indigenous child is more likely to end up in jail than they are to finish school? You're more likely to end up in jail than to reach Year 12. We need a new way of thinking about these things. Because how do we understand ourselves when we haven't managed to address the rates of Aboriginal deaths in custody? What does it say about us that as a nation we aren't prioritising working collaboratively with Indigenous leaders in addressing these problems? We need to look at things from a different view, a new perspective. We need to think about our First Nations people like God thinks about them, as created in his image, as treasured children of God, as valued and valuable. Reconciliation is part of God's mission in the world, and it involves being able to tell the truth about our history. We're called to love our neighbour, even the ones we don't understand, even the ones we have hurt in the past. Because I think we often think about, how do I love the neighbour that hurt me? But we forget to think about, how do I love the neighbour that I hurt? How do I forgive myself for that? And how do I ask them to forgive me? As a nation, we have hurt Aboriginal people, and we have to be able to find a way to love them despite our nation's shameful past. We have to love our neighbour even when we don't feel like their problems are our problems. Even when it's hard, even when it's complicated, even when it's overwhelming. But we need a vision for what that might look like. It requires questioning the status quo and the assumptions that we make. And I'm excited about that yarning circle because it gives you the opportunity to bring your assumptions. We have to examine the baggage that we bring to reconciliation, the assumptions we make, the stereotypes that we hold. And we all do, because we've been conditioned by a society to think and act and respond a certain way. And we have to be a little bit like Jesus. We have to be completely countercultural, and we have to put ourselves out on a limb and love. In a hostile world, we have to take the risk to love. Any good relationship counsellor will tell you that you can't change the other person. You can only change yourself. You can only change the way you respond, the expectations that you have, and the way you choose to conduct yourself and the conversations you have. You can't change the other person, only yourself. Guess what? We need to change. We can't approach reconciliation with the same old ideas of if they just did this, then that would happen. We need to approach reconciliation with the idea of what do I need to change in me? What assumptions do I need to change? What things do I need to challenge in my own life? Can I continue to live in a little bubble and live a blinkered life, not examining how my own privilege affects those around me? Not examining how my own privilege is actually at the cost of somebody else's dignity. I think we still sometimes approach reconciliation with a bit of an assimilation era hangover and the idea of if, then. If they do X, then Y will happen. But what if we took responsibility? Responsibility and change are risky things. It involves vulnerability and risk. But God honours those who take a courageous stand in the face of adversity. Speaking up against racism when you encounter it is a great place to start. But you might even need to take a step back further. You might need to be aware of racist talk when you hear it. Sometimes we don't even notice it, we're so used to it. It's about self-awareness and awareness of other. Being aware of our own prejudices and tendencies to stereotype is something we can all do, and I'm really hopeful that the Yarning Circle will be a safe place where people can have their ideas challenged. Because it's only when we challenge each other that we grow. The little things that we do to validate racism, like not even noticing it or thinking it's okay to have the face of an Aboriginal man on a $2 coin, is so ingrained in our culture, but it's not inconsequential. It's one of the ways that we end up with massive disparity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous. It's one of the ways our First Nations people end up feeling that they only exist at the mercy of others. Society is held together or comes undone through the permissions that we give each other. And these permissions lie along a continuum from embracing difference through to rigid hostility. And when we adopt discriminatory language and policy, we shift further and further along that continuum towards the prospect of real violence. Real violence, like the stain of massacres that we have on our history, but also like the recent revelations of abuse at the Dondale Youth Detention Centre in the Northern Territory. We allow those things by not speaking up, by not challenging, by not recognising that we each have a role to play and a responsibility. Paul tells the people of Corinth and us that we must look at things differently now that we know Christ. We must look at things differently because we have been transformed. We need to look at reconciliation differently, not from a position of defensiveness and justification about how things were done in the past, not from a position of denial of, I didn't do it, so it's not my fault, but from a position of love, mercy and sincere hope that we might actually see God's kingdom come and his will being done. And we need to know that we can play an active part in that. What does reconciliation look like? It looks like hope. It looks like charity. It looks like love. It looks like self-awareness and the courage to try and change ourselves, not demand change from the other. Discovering my heritage was a sad relief for me. I had to look at my Nana differently, to understand all she had lost in trying to gain a future for her children and grandchildren. I felt angry at her that she'd denied me my heritage. I had to look at it differently. I can never understand what it must have been like for her to walk away from who you are to protect those who are still to come. I had to look at myself differently because I wanted to be proud of my heritage, not ashamed like my Nana had been taught to be. And so I still retreat into my happy little bubble sometimes to recharge and recover. But I live in hope that there are enough people in the world who really do want and really do believe when they pray, Your kingdom come. Amen.